News. From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Later in the broadcast, protecting your personal time in an era of non-stop connectivity, how technology is blurring the line between home and office. But first, the mainstream media takes on bloggers. Last week, the Associated Press sent a letter to the liberal blog The Drudge Retort, not to be confused with The Drudge Report. The Drudge Retort started 10 years ago as a parody of the conservative Drudge Report, but 5 years ago it became a social news site where members can post links and comments. Well, anyway, the AP sent a letter to the aforementioned Drudge Retort, ordering it to take down several items with quotes from AP articles. To the AP, it's a basic issue of protecting its intellectual property. Media outlets around the country pay the AP for its articles, and if other people can get those articles for free, suffice it to say, it hurts the business model. But bloggers argue that quoting from articles should be considered fair use, and that the practice is essential to the very nature of blogging. So, is this a classic example of old media battling the new? And if so, how does this fight get resolved? Joining us by telephone from St. Augustine in Florida is Rogers Cadenhead, owner of the Drudge Retort website. Rogers Cadenhead, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I hope I have a soothing voice that sounds good on NPR.
It certainly does. Last week, the AP asked you to take down quotations from its articles that were posted on your website. How much content from each article were you putting on your site?
Well, in the 7 articles in question, users of the Drudge Retort had quoted roughly 35 to 75 words from AP stories that were linked on different sites across the web.
I understand that before this incident, you were asked by the Associated Press to remove a blog entry that was basically the full text of a copyrighted article. How did you handle that?
Yes, I was contacted in May, and they had identified, the AP attorneys had identified a few instances where users had quoted the full text or substantial text from an article. And at that time, I promptly removed them and told them to notify me if it happened in the future, because both sides agree that that's not a acceptable use under copyright law.
So if you reproduce or on your website are reproduced short excerpts of articles ranging in length from 33 to 79 words, you don't see anything wrong with that?
In most cases, no. The software that I designed for the site limits the summary of news stories that users link to 100 characters or 400 characters, which is around 80 words. And I don't see many circumstances where quoting 80 words from a news article wouldn't constitute fair use in my thinking.
Well, we invited the Associated Press to join us for this conversation, but the AP declined. So, Rogers, what do you think constitutes fair use of a copyrighted news article?
Well, in terms of the blogosphere and social news sites like my own and Dig and Mix, I think that the ethos that has sprung up is that when you are referring to a news article and linking to the news article, quoting 1 to 3 sentences of that article directly is a fair respect for the article's copyright. It's hard to say. There's no real hard and fast line that you can rely on when deciding, as I was forced to decide whether the users of my site were engaging in legal behavior or not in the face of AP's attorneys, the letters that they sent. But if you are an avid reader of blogs, you'll find that kind of quotation is common practice throughout the web.
If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call us at 800-433-8850. And we're talking on Tech Tuesday about bloggers and traditional media. Rogers, where are you with AP right now? I saw an article that indicated that you at one point considered filing suit against the Associated Press.
Actually, that's nowhere near where we are at this point. The AP is going to be meeting with the Media Bloggers Association, as I'm sure you're going to cover later in this. And I'm confident that something good will come out of that meeting. One of the things, when you face the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and takedown demands, it's very difficult to foster a dialogue in the face of that. No users of the retort has filed a DMCA counter notice, So we're at a point where we can discuss what's fair, and I think that talking about potential legal actions would short-circuit that process, and I'd hate to see that happen.
Here's Lynn in Fairfax, Virginia. Lynn, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify that there is always a link to the original material, and it's just a question of how that original material is referenced in the blog.
Yes, absolutely. I'm a former newspaper reporter myself, and one of the reasons I started the Retort was to find interesting and noteworthy articles on the web. We've got about 8,500 users who post stories that are interesting to them at Drudge.com, and they're always with credit and with link. It's not an example of trying to rewrite and take this kind of traffic. We send people directly to the publishers of these stories, such as Yahoo News, AP, Washington Post, and so on.
But do you now find yourself in the position, Rogers, of policing those 8,500 members of your website's postings?
I'm sorry, doing what with them?
Do you find yourself now having to police their postings to make sure that they accord to what you think is appropriate?
Well, under the current law, a service provider like I am is not required to exercise prior restraint over what we publish. Stories go directly on the site that are written by users. So though I'm not policing them beforehand, I'm certainly taking a closer look at the behavior we're engaged in to make sure that everyone's rights are respected. I mean, I think that's just a natural consequence of a situation like this, because getting a C&D is not a pleasant experience.
Rogers Cadenhead, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for calling me. I appreciate it.
Rogers Cadenhead is owner of the website The Drudge Retort. Joining us in our studio is Matthew Felling, media analyst, former media critic with CBSNews.com and the Center for Media and Public Affairs. Matthew, always a pleasure.
Hey, thank you very much, Kojo.
And joining us by telephone from New Rochelle, New York, is Bob Kotz, president of the Media Bloggers Association. That's an organization dedicated to the development of blogging or citizen journalism as a distinct form of media. Bob Kotz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Starting with you, Matthew, what do you think constitutes the fair use of a copyrighted news article? Is it okay to take 50 words of a 100-word article, for example? Where would you draw the line?
Well, I think that the line is almost impossible to draw, because it depends on where those 50 words are taken from. And I thought that a legal scholar in the New York Times yesterday was talking about how the AP was saying, even if you use the first paragraph, that is a violation, or they believe that they can argue the case that it's a violation of fair use, because their premise is that they can boil everything down to that first paragraph, which I find an extremely slippery and elusive argument to make, and most people in the legal community don't agree with that. But in my most recent incarnation as an accidental blogger for CBSNews.com, where I was editor of Public Eye, I would always make excerpts part of my copy, because it was it showed the relevance, it showed to the readers what the arguments of the day were, what the stories of the day out there were. You would indent them, you would limit it to maybe the key quote or the key couple sentences to drive your discussion, to drive the point that you were making, and then just take it from there. On some occasions, I would use two or three paragraphs if the case was extremely strong that this article was making, but at the same time, I had never heard anything, any complaints against what I was doing at CBSNews.com. Also, I would find my work completely, in its entirety, sometimes 750, sometimes 1,000 words, excerpted, sometimes with links, sometimes without links. And the only time I called them to complain was when they spelled my name wrong or said, listen, it's Public Eye over at CBSNews.com. And so much of the web and so much of blogging and blog commentary is just interconnection and the relationships and the links. And a lot of people, a lot of bloggers particularly, probably would just think that any publicity is good publicity. And if the AP wants to crack down, the blogging community is not going to like that. And there's been a lot of examples of people inside the blogging community who say, as long as the AP is going to be like this, we'll just stop using their copy altogether. And then that stops the traffic going to AP-related sites. And that's nowhere you want to go either.
Bob Kotz, your take on this. Where should the line be drawn?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, AP has some legitimate copyright issues here, and there's one that has not been brought up in any of the media coverage, which is they're not just alleging straight traditional copyright claims. There's also, under New York state law, where they're operating a hot news copyright claim, and that's also part of what they're claiming here. So it has to do both with the actual content, and then it has to do with, I guess you'd call it, the news value of the content and the timeliness of the content.
So a hot news copyright claim means that you're reproducing their material too quickly?
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm reluctant to go too deep into that pool.
Okay.
I'm just making the point that there's multiple claims here. There are some legitimate points that they're making. It seems to me the real problem is that AP has been saying and said in the past a lot of things about recognizing the blogosphere and the ethos of excerpting and linking and so forth, and yet their legal department is operating on a different, more aggressive or restrictive understanding of fair use. And I think that what they're struggling with is trying to bring into balance sort of the journalism publishing side of their business and where their lawyers are at. And I don't think they've done that quite yet, but that's, I think, what they're working towards this week.
Matthew, this seems to be a classic example of the old versus new media, but is the idea of old versus new still even relevant, given that blogs are now a crucial part of many mainstream news operations?
Yeah, I think old and new are just kind of blending together. As we see, Washington Post has bloggers, New York Times has bloggers. I was a blogger at the Tiffany Network, for Lord's sake, and I think that when you're... Old, I would think that some people inside the progressive community have called it, you know, like the traditional media instead of mainstream media, because they are thinking that they are part of the mainstream now, too. And it is the old, the quote-unquote old, quote-unquote traditional media has co-opted a lot of the new technologies and then a lot of the new approaches to the extent that blogging is just part of the conversation, and it's a conversation that is being shared by mainstream organs. And I think where we are right now with the AP is that long ago, when the blogs were just beginning, and even before the blogs were in existence, the internet by itself has just always been this this complete tripping point when it comes to legalisms and media, because it's the international waters. It's like the pirate seas of information. How do you go out there, even if the AP wins this? How do they go out and police more content on more blogs? What if you go to sitting at my computer in my sandals, blogger.com, and you start ripping off AP? I mean, how does this crackdown get applied and enforced? I understand what they're saying in principle, but at the same time, picking a fight with bloggers I don't know how many new blogs are created every day, but it's in the hundreds or thousands. I don't know what sort of a fight, to what extent they're trying to wage.
Bob, what are you expecting in the meeting that you're having with AP this week? I suspect that AP is going to say, look, we're a little different from other media in that this is our business model here. We rely on our members to pay us for their articles because, unlike a lot of other media outlets, we can't really rely on advertising revenue to provide a financial cushion. Do you think that's what AP is likely to say?
Well, I mean, I've been talking to AP all along since last week, so I have a pretty good idea of what we're going to talk about. Let's keep in mind that there's still a blogger here, and that's who we're trying to help out, and that's why we asked for this meeting in the first place, not initially to discuss some broader issues, but to get into the issue specifically of the currently outstanding DMCA takedown notice, which under DMCA law, the way it works is that it was filed on June 10th. He has 10 days to respond, so he has to respond with a counterclaim in federal court by Friday. And if he doesn't, then basically the stuff stays down. So we're trying to talk to them about that first and hopefully get that squared away. And then what we offered to do was talk to them about maybe AP articulating what exactly it is they are looking for from bloggers, because that's the piece that's been missing. They never have really said what it is that they want. And, anything we could do to help them think through what some guidelines might look like would be useful. And then something we would like to do, and it could have helped here, is if they have problems with particular bloggers, reach out to people like us. We have relationships with an awful lot of bloggers, and maybe we could try to work something out before they go to the nuclear option of a threat letter.
Matthew?
Yes, I'm not trying to come across as the ultimate champion of the blogs, because I think that a lot of when we're talking about bloggers versus traditional media, bloggers assume some primacy or assume some importance that they shouldn't allow themselves. I think that bloggers should always remember that without the AP, without the Washington Post of the world, without the New York Times, you don't have your source material to even begin to talk about. So there needs to be a respect for each other's views that altogether in the bellicose environment of the blogosphere is sometimes lost.
Allow me to go to Helen in Bethesda, Maryland. Helen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, how are you? This is a great conversation. Isn't it a bit like quote, you know, a headline or a couple of sentences, and then blogging meaning sort of an electronic way of just giving your opinion. Isn't it a bit like wearing a sleeve or a collar and giving your opinion of the entire outfit when the person that you're talking to has not seen the whole thing? It doesn't make any sense to me.
That would be your turn, Bob Cox.
Thanks. Well, I would say this. First of all, what is going on with a site like Rogers, Cadenhead's site, is they're posting up sort of quick links to the news item, and then people are voting on it, and then they're pushing it up further and further so more and more people can see it. So it isn't necessarily always about an excerpt and then adding commentary or analysis to it. And that actually is an important issue under copyright law, which is that there has to be something transformative about what the person is doing. And if all they're doing is putting up the material straight from AP with their headline and their opening paragraph, that does open up an issue there. So it's not necessarily clear that they're on solid ground. I mean, this is why it's a debate. What I would say is that from our perspective, you know, there ought to be ways that the AP can protect their copyright interest and still allow this kind of social media, news media, you know, to develop and evolve. And ultimately, it probably redounds to the benefit of AP. As was said earlier, ultimately, this is links and traffic going back to AP customers, and it's something that they should want. I will tell you just one statistic, which is that I remember hearing this from people at the New York Times, that you know, like 20% or more of their traffic is now coming off of blogs. So any news organization should be wanting to figure out a way to get the benefit of all that, but also they have a legitimate interest in protecting their copyright.
Helen, thank you very much for your call. Matthew Helen is saying that would be like me saying that you're wearing a nice tie today and people concluding that because of that, you're a really snappy dresser all the time, which is still up in the air as far as I'm concerned.
Well, as far as you're concerned, but you did compliment me on my tie when I walked in. No, I think the key is, and the spirit of blogging is to have a sentence or two or three, and then to make your point, you know, to kind of create your own little talk radio station online where you say, this is what happened, or the Mets just fired their manager last night at 3 a.m, and then go off for five paragraphs of your own. And myself, as a accidental blogger at CBS and as a person who reads these things every day, whenever I see somebody, you know, from the left wing or from the right wing quoting an AP story or quoting a primary source and then making their case, you know, and going far flung off onto their own rants, I will almost always go to the AP story.
Same here.
Or go to the Washington Post story and say, you know what? I'll bet they're leaving something extremely crucial out. You know, like the O'Reillys and the Oldmans of the world, where they'll yank out a couple of the facts that, you know, lend to their general narrative, and then they leave out the parts that weaken their case. I always try to have that banter in my own head, which drives me crazy and a lot of people in America crazy, going on with respect to finding out what the source material was and figuring out whether or not the tie makes the outfit.
Matthew Felling is a media analyst, a snappy dresser, and former media critic with CBSNews.com and the Center for Media and Public Affairs. Matthew, thank you very much for dropping by.
Thank you.
Bob Cox, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and I'm in my pajamas, so don't worry about it.
Bob Cox, resplendent in his pajamas, is president of the Media Bloggers Association. That's a nonpartisan organization dedicated to the development of blogging or citizen journalism as a distinct form of media. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Tech Tuesday, the 24/7 workplace. I'm Kojo Nandi.
You're listening to WAMU 88.5. I'm Matt McCleskey.
Next time on Tell Me More, uncomfortable situations and everyday life. From time to time, we call on the writers of O Magazine's ethics column, Now What Do I Do, for advice, like what to do about men who greet women with unwanted kisses.
I feel like hugging is the great connector. So I said just breeze right past his lips and give him a hug.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
And that's coming up at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
I'm Eric Kneeler from Capital News Connection. Join us Friday evenings at 5:44 and 7:44 for This Week in Congress, a weekly wrap-up and look ahead from Capitol Hill. That's every Friday evening during All Things Considered right here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the Association of American Railroads, today's freight railroads are committed to working hard for the environment by moving a ton of freight 436 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel. More online at freightrailworks.org. From Hodgson Consulting, an Ektron Gold partner, providing content management solutions for clients' web-based initiatives. Hodgson Consulting, fueled by technology, powered by people. On the web at hodgsonconsult.com.
It's easy to understand why wireless email devices and smartphones are so popular among white-collar workers. Those gadgets give people the freedom to take their work out of the office to do business anywhere at any time. But is there a catch? Smartphones and BlackBerries also give your boss 24/7 access to you. On the weekends, at ball games, at romantic dinners, you may even feel obligated to respond to the emails you get when you're not officially on the clock. But should your boss be obligated to pay you when you're still checking your office email at midnight? Joining us to have this Tech Tuesday conversation is Catherine Pragel, an attorney at Littler Mendelson. Catherine Pragel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us from studios in Columbus, Ohio, is Nancy Flynn, Executive Director of the ePolicy Institute. Nancy Flynn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Joining us by telephone from Los Angeles is Jonathan Taplin, professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. Jonathan Taplin, glad to have you aboard.
Thank you.
And joining us by telephone from Chappaqua, New York, is Walter Olson, who is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and editor of the websites overlawyered.com and pointoflaw.com. Walter Olson, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Nancy, allow me to start with you. Gadgets like the BlackBerry have taken off in cities like Washington, D.C., where productivity and efficiency are the name of the game. The mayor of this town, Adrian Fenty, even brags that he carries 3 BlackBerries with him at all times. How have these devices actually affected workplace efficiency in America?
Well, what's interesting is email was initially created to be a time-consuming and productivity-enhancing tool. But what we're seeing is as more of these handhelds enter the scene, oftentimes it's actual 9-to-5 productivity that's suffering. In fact, ePolicy Institute conducts a survey every year in conjunction with American Management Association, and our research reveals that 86% of employees engage in personal email when they're on the clock, and 10% of employees actually spend 4 or more hours a day, that's half the workday, emailing. So it's really incumbent upon employers to put, and of course I'm from the ePolicy Institute, so you won't be surprised by this, but employers want to put rules and policies in place governing personal use and governing off-hour use of BlackBerries, smartphones, and other portable tools. And before employees access that technology, they want to make sure they're familiar with the rules so they don't join the 58% of workers who were fired last year for inappropriate email and internet use.
Jonathan, you, how do you feel about this issue, how these devices affect workplace efficiency in America?
Well, you know, we've seen obviously a great rise in productivity for the middle management worker, but his median family income has not risen. And I would suggest that one of the reasons that is because he's getting paid for 8 hours a day and he's working 12, 14, maybe more. The BlackBerry is checked the first thing when he gets out of bed in the morning and is checked the last thing before he goes to sleep. And he has complete kind of tied to the device. And I've even heard of hotels offering CrackBerry vacations where the wife checks the husband in the hotel and he's forced to put his BlackBerry in a safe deposit box for the weekend.
Indeed, the term CrackBerry is for those people who have become apparently addicted to emailing and text messaging. Do you buy into the CrackBerry idea, Jonathan?
I do, but I also agree with the earlier caller that there is a lack of efficiency. There was a researcher at UC at Irvine, Gloria Mark, who studied worker productivity and said that she found that the basic 21st century office worker starts a job, works only 11 minutes on any given project before they get interrupted, then they get interrupted, and then it takes them almost 25 minutes to get back to the task that they were meant to do because of all the interruptions. And so, you know, I think there's both a downside to having all these ability to reach workers all the time, and, of course, then there's the pay problem as well.
It's my understanding, Jonathan, that Microsoft is experimenting with email filters on its computers that would only allow employees to check their accounts at certain intervals. What's the point of that?
Well, Google actually was the first one that came up with a program for their employees called Email Addict. And what it did was allow you to set a program that would turn off your email and your ability to know that you were getting emails for a specific period of time, say 30 minutes, and it would send a message out to your correspondents that I'm can't be interrupted. And then in 25 minutes or 30 minutes, it would let you know what number of emails you had, because they felt that certain employees didn't want to be interrupted. And Intel has done a similar program where they're trying to have like a quiet Friday where you don't do as much email. Because what they found was people were actually sending emails to people who were three cubicles away from them in a big room when they could have actually walked next door and had a more human interaction.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation we're calling BlackBerry Overtime. You can join it by calling 800-433-8850. How often do you use an office BlackBerry or cell phone or laptop when you are away from the office? And do you think you deserve compensation for that time? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Let's talk about the legal issues here a little bit, Catherine Pragel, because workers everywhere in America are using these devices to work overtime, and federal law determines when workers are entitled to overtime pay. How could someone get overtime for any extra hours they spent typing away on a BlackBerry or a smartphone during the weekend or in the evenings at home?
Well, under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, any employee who is classified as non-exempt from overtime and minimum wage requirements is entitled to overtime for all hours worked over 40 in a week. So if an employee is checking overtime or checking email, BlackBerries, cell phones after hours, that can add up to more than 40 hours of time a week. And since it's on electronic device, it's an amount of time that's recordable and able to be substantiated.
Because it's an electronic device, there is a digital trail, so to speak.
Exactly. There's a paper trail in a digital format. Exactly.
Walter Olson, do you carry a BlackBerry, and what rules do you or your office have for you carrying it?
I'm probably the only one on this panel who lives in a dead zone where I can't get cell connection. So I've been freed to write about this addiction without actually having it myself. But yeah, working at my desk, I don't draw a line between an end of a business day and a beginning of a business day. I will answer business email at 12 midnight, and by the same token, I feel very little guilt about doing personal business at 3 in the afternoon. And I think this is typical of the way more and more people's jobs are structured, which is that you are expected to meet your deadlines and get work done, but there is less objection on many employees' parts to continuing to check the email and not making a sharp differentiation if I won't answer the work email until 9 a.m. And by the same token, I think among smarter employers, there's more of a recognition that that people will often have one email in basket asking them not to deal with any of the personal stuff, even if it's interesting. It's not as reasonable a request as it used to be.
Catherine, your firm specializes in employment issues. Do you believe that BlackBerries are likely to be the next front in workplace litigation?
I do. There's actually been a recent explosion, especially in the last few years, in overtime claims under the Fair Labor Standards Act being brought, including class actions, a number of class actions and collective actions. And this is an area that's definitely ripe for that. and I think it has to do with a lot of the things that people have touched on already, the Crackberry. It's almost instinctual for employees to want to check it. You hear that buzz on your BlackBerry, you're going to check it, even if, you know, even if it's after hours, even if it's off the clock. And most employers currently have policies in place that say you can't work overtime without authorization or you can be subject to discipline. And that creates some tension where there's this instinctual need to check the BlackBerry, even if you know, all right, maybe technically I'm working off the clock by doing so. And usually where this is going to come up is if an employee is disgruntled, they can go back and say, you know what, I've actually been checking my BlackBerry after hours, I've been checking on the weekend, I've been responding to cell phone calls, and all of this is substantiated because you can just look back in your electronic files, and it's kind of a very meaty, easy to demonstrate and easy to
substantiate. In other words, my CrackBerry, my BlackBerry addiction is my employer's fault, and therefore I can now sue my employer because I am addicted and need some form of rehabilitation.
Even if it's not your employer's fault, you could be doing it without authorization. Your employer, but it does. It's almost a strict liability under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Even if you don't have authorization to be working off the clock, they're still liable for it.
Well, Walter, not all jobs are the same. Factory workers have a different idea of the work week than, say, screenwriters do. Are job fields subject to the same wage and hour rules?
Well, part of the problem is that the law in question was drafted probably before any of us on this panel were born. It was a New Deal law, which was made very much for the factory era, and it may still fit for jobs in that category. It fits less and less well with every passing year as jobs get transformed by the new technology. And so the question is, you know, are we going to wait another 50 years to go revisit it, or are we going to try to figure out if we like the idea of the law? And there's all, you know, debate about that too. But if we like it, how do we modernize it to fit the way the workplace has changed?
Nancy Flynn, what kind of policy should offices put in place to make sure employees know when they're on call and when they need to respond to emails, texts, or cell phone calls?
Right. Well, the key word there, Kojo, is know. So employees know. And what we have found in our American Management Association ePolicy Institute research is while 76% of organizations do in fact have an email policy in place, employers really drop the ball when it comes to training employees. Only about 40% of employers actually insist that employees go through a training program that covers issues including BlackBerry use, productivity, as well as content and usage. And just to go back to something Professor Kaplan said, I completely agree that employers need to take advantage of these technology tools that are out there to try to help employees more effectively use these tools. So, for example, in our most recent survey, we found that the majority of employers are now using what are called URL blocks to stop employees automatically from visiting personal websites. And then, as I recommend in a couple of my recent books, the ePolicy Handbook and Email Management, employers should put in place rules that spell out specifically at what intervals employees are allowed to download email. Because as Professor Kaplan said earlier, the organization and the individual can control that, and they should. And one final point I would want to make is often when employees go online, whether they're using their BlackBerry or a smartphone or a laptop, if they're on vacation or they're at their daughter's softball game or they're otherwise away from the office, a lot of times that's voluntary activity. They have not been instructed by management to log on and take care of a certain project. They've just made that decision to do it on their free time. So again, I think that's where those written rules and policies can be so helpful, and you want to support that with training and technology tools.
Allow me to go to the telephones. Here's Deb in Leesburg, Virginia. Deb, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I wake up in the middle of the night to this zzzz of the rollerball on the BlackBerry. My husband, if he wakes up and he's stressed about the job, or he's been dreaming about a project, he wakes up, he checks his BlackBerry, and that's what I wake up to. And my concern is there's no downtime. Even in the middle of the night, there's no downtime.
Yeah.
Jonathan Taplin?
I'd say that this notion that this is some kind of addiction is not really true. I think employees are caught in what game theory people call the prisoner's dilemma. They don't think if they don't do all of this and work till 11 o'clock, well, one of their competitors within their peers within their firm will be doing it. They'll get problems within the firm. And so they're all kind of caught in this trap. And I would totally agree with Nancy and have to disagree with Walter. Companies actually are doing very strong policies to block employees from doing personal work during the business time. So the notion that, oh, we're all kind of mixing this up and I can do lots of personal stuff. I mean, AT&T blocks access to ESPN and eBay, so employees cannot do that kind of stuff during work time. But they do not block access, obviously, to their employees at 11 o'clock at night when the boss wants something for tomorrow morning's 8 o'clock meeting.
Walter Olson, care to respond to that?
Yeah, well, let me jump in, because I have no doubt that Jonathan is correctly describing the policies that many large employers have been led to take, often on legal advice that, you know, they'd better have such a policy for various reasons of litigation. I think that it's unfortunate and in many ways a business handicap for a business to come across as rule-bound and bureaucratized, and I think that it's harder for them to keep and attract many young creative workers if they are competing with a small software shop or communications shop of some sort, which doesn't have elaborate rules on when you can and for what you can use the Internet.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll get back to your phone calls. There's still a couple of lines open. Deb, thank you for your call. The number is 800-433-8850, or you can send your email to kojo@wamu.org. What's expected at your office when your boss emails you after work hours? Are you obligated to respond immediately? 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up at 1, gender identity and human rights, understanding America's often invisible transgender community. Today at 1 on The Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon, I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, uncomfortable situations and everyday life. From time to time, we call on the writers of O Magazine's ethics column, Now What Do I Do, for advice. Like what to do about men who greet women with unwanted kisses.
I feel like hugging is the great connector. So I said just breeze right past his lips and give him a hug.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
And that's coming up at 2 o'clock, right after the second hour of the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the German Embassy and the German Information Center, now celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Berlin Airlift. In 1948, the airlift created a legacy of friendship. More information is at germany.info.
It's currently 76 degrees in Northwest Washington at 12:45 as the Kojo Namdi Show continues here on WAMU 88.5.
It's Tech Tuesday, the 24/7 work week, or BlackBerry Overtime. We're talking with Nancy Flynn, Executive Director of the ePolicy Institute. Jonathan Taplin is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. Walter Olson is Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and editor of the websites overlawyer.com and pointoflaw.com. And Catherine Pragel is an attorney at Littler Mendelsohn. Catherine Pragel, people talk a lot about how addicted they've become to the smartphone or wireless email gadgets they use at work. What would happen if they tried to sue their employers for bringing about these tech addictions?
I don't know how much of a claim they might have for bringing about an actual addiction to their BlackBerries, but for overtime claims, I think they certainly would. And I think there's definitely a lot of these claims on the horizon. I mentioned before that there's been something of an explosion of Fair Labor Standards Act wage and hour claims the last couple of years. A lot of those have had to do with misclassification of employees as exempt when they should have been non-exempt. And I think this is going to be the biggest problem going forward, because at this point, with the expense of certain BlackBerries and other handheld devices, it's mostly probably exempt employees who are being issued these. But if you have a claim brought that some of these employees were misclassified as exempt and now they're entitled to all this overtime, they can go back to their BlackBerry records and show all this documented hours of overtime that they might have spent using their BlackBerries. And this is just a very ripe claim. I've already seen it recently in terms of cell phone usage and misclassification claims, where plaintiff's attorneys can go back and take a look and say, hey, I want your cell phone records for the past 3 years. And they can go line by line and day by day and demonstrate there was a call after hours, there was a call after hours, there was a call after hours, and it lasted 3 minutes and 45 seconds. And you add that up over 3 years, couple years, it adds up to a significant amount of money.
Walter Olson, another scenario. Could you make a case against your employer if you were physically injured while using a device your office gave you, like if you were in a car accident while you were sending a wireless email?
There have been a few legal claims like that, and often they are by not the employee herself or himself, but a third party in the car crash saying that they were distracted, and who distracted them? It was you, the employer, because they were doing business on their BlackBerry. That's not totally off the wall as far as the existing state of the law, because you've got well laid out rules for workers' compensation. If you're doing a car errand for your employer, they may be on the hook. Beyond that, as far as the driver themselves, usually there's going to be the question of why weren't you paying more attention to the road? And so lawsuit by the actual driver, I'm not aware of any that have worked yet.
Allow me to go back to the telephones. Here's Linda in Potomac, Maryland. Linda, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. This is a great program, and I'll tell you, I've actually had some direct experience just recently with this. My company, because of a class action suit, had to reclassify me to non-exempt from exempt. Of course, part of that is that they actually decreased my pay, but because I'm sort of a completely 24/7 employee, I am now making a lot more money with overtime. And at least I feel like if somebody calls me, like one of my clients calls me at 3 o'clock in the morning, at least I'm getting some sort of compensation for getting up and taking that call. But I'll tell you, it's a really difficult situation out here. You can't get away from this. The economy forces you to keep your jobs, and you just have to go along with the way the company does things.
Nancy Flynn, care to comment on that?
Well, again, I think both for the benefit of employees and employers, employers could do a much better job of putting really clear rules into place and then communicating those rules to employees. But one point I'd like to make also, and I certainly empathize with employees like the caller who are perhaps called upon by employers and clients to work really crazy hours and justifiably so, perhaps want to be compensated for that time. But, you know, on the other hand, we also have the issue of younger employees, employees who are in their 20s and even in their teens, who have grown up so connected and so committed to technology tools that these folks find it almost impossible to disconnect. So I think that it's very difficult in some situations to kind of draw that line. Is the employer insisting employees 24/7, or is it just that we've become such an electronic culture that, again, people voluntarily are opting to use these tools at all hours of the day and night?
Linda, thank you for your call. Jonathan Taplin, here's an email we got from Irving, who says, about workplace culture, one thing you're not talking about is the grief that CrackBerry users cause workers back at the home office. BlackBerry users think that because they have a device and can send you email from anywhere, that the people back at the office should attend to their immediate needs. Well, immediately. I would guess that anyone whose boss has a BlackBerry has gotten the unintelligible email that was clearly sent from the back of a cab. If it's really important, then a phone call should be made, but BlackBerry users don't understand that. Jonathan Taplin, talk about a little bit about the effect that the use of these devices have on interpersonal communication, person-to-person, actually people actually talking to one another.
Well, this is one of these discoveries that Intel made when they tried out this practice of taking a day away from electronic communication and making people communicate directly. They found that it helped build teams. It helped build real relationships. We have this illusion that a social network, which we used to think of as a group of people who would meet and go to the bar at the end of the week after a long week of work, is now just an electronic group of people on Facebook, some of which we may not even really know. That is not really what social ties, how they're built. And so the actual face-to-face point is important. And when Intel realized that people who were literally four cubicles away were communicating purely electronically and not even seeing each other during the course of the day, they found that actually forcing people to go face-to-face was helpful.
Here is Scott in Arlington, Virginia. Scott, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My comment from listening to most of the show with the URL blocking and the idea of only letting people download email at certain time intervals, being in the IT field, it sounds to me that companies that you've mentioned, like AT&T, Intel, they're a more centralized, and maybe managers don't have as much influence in on the departmental level. I find it hard, and I'm curious if your panel has any advice. I find it hard getting individual departmental managers. You've got marketing, you've got accounting, you've got HR, you name it, who you might get a couple on board, but how do you make your case for these policies to please everyone, or at least get them on board? I mean, do you use legal precedents that, you know, some of the cases that you've mentioned? Is there a better way to approach it than, you know, just explaining the policy to them? That's really, I think, a lot of my problem, and even probably a lot of people in the IT field, getting those individual, because you get one manager who doesn't get a response from his team through an email until they're able to download their email, and that's just not going to work.
Walter Olson, care to address this issue?
Well, and the question had a lot of different questions. It seems to me that several of the points we've been talking about the last few minutes, if I were running a company, I would make everyone go through a seminar on email courtesy, because sometimes it's courteous to send an email to the person four cubicles over, and sometimes it's very rude, and it, depending on what's expected of them, it may ruin the next hour for them, or they may think, good, he's not going to make me respond to it for an hour because he only sent an email rather than making me talk to him. The boss who runs his employees ragged by the misuse of email needs a visit from someone at the company the same way as if he or she were doing it by personally showing up and making their work miserable. And again, the technology changes it, but you're going to have bad managers and need a way of monitoring what they're doing under any of the technologies.
Catherine Pregel, this email we got from Molly in Arlington. I'm sure many of the employees who are using these tools are consultants, as I am. When I was hired, I had to sign an agreement saying I was ineligible for overtime. What are the laws governing this exemption?
Well, if it's a actual consultant in terms of an independent contractor, then they are not bound by the FLSA in terms of working for an actual employer and that employer being liable to that employee for overtime, because they're not an employee, they're an independent contractor. So as a consultant and that independent contractor, you are your own employer and you are making your own hours. So in that case, an employer would not be liable.
Walter, are labor laws in other countries more protective, any more protected of white-collar workers' rights to overtime pay than we are?
I wish I had the answer to that at my fingertips, but I'll bet Catherine knows more about that than I do.
Catherine?
There are very strict overtime laws elsewhere as well, and even within this country, there's different states that have stricter overtime laws in terms of daily overtime. Employees can only work 8 hours a day, and after which they're entitled to overtime. So there are definitely stricter policies out there than the federal law, including internationally.
Nancy Flynn, why am I getting the impression that a lot of these workplace rules that are not now in place will ultimately be worked out in lawsuits?
Well, absolutely. In fact, what we tell our clients here at ePolicy Institute is that email creates the electronic equivalent of DNA evidence. Anything you put in writing can come back to hurt you and your employer. And as Catherine has pointed out today, that includes the amount of time you're spending on these devices. So, again, I just want to hammer home, and this also applies to the most recent caller's question. The most effective way for organizations to manage employee email use, and that includes productive, effective use and trying to keep a lid on unreasonable expectations when it comes to the use of these electronic business communications tools, is you want to put together a formal email management program that combines what we call the three E's. One, you establish written policy. Number two, educate the workforce, and that's everybody from the summer intern to the CEO. And then number three, you enforce your policies with technology tools, and that includes tools to block access to inappropriate and personal URLs, to monitor and filter employee email, and just overall to try to protect your organization's assets and reputation.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Nancy Flynn is Executive Director of the ePolicy Institute. Catherine Pregler is an attorney at Littler Mendelsohn. Jonathan Taplin is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. And Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and editor of the websites overlawyer.com and pointoflaw.com. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, local political leaders walk the tightrope between what's legal and what's ethical, from jobs for family members to preferential loans, plus gripping nonfiction, guilty pleasures, and page turners for kids, recommendations for great summer reading. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon, I'm Matt McCleskey. The second hour of today's Kojo Nandi Show is coming up next.